In this edition of the Metro Weekly Podcast, we explore several DC area stage productions, beginning with an interview of playwright Ken Ludwig and his hit show, Lend Me a Soprano. Then we have four reviews, including Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along at Keegan Theatre, the World War I musical, Private Jones at Signature Theatre, a musical comedy, Desperate Measures, at Constellation Theatre, and finishing with The Sensational Seamingkets at Woolly Mammoth Theatre.
We start today with Raising the Pitch. Tony-winning playwright Ken Ludwig retools his beloved 1986 farce, Lend Me a Tenor, with a clever operatic gender swap. By Randy Shulman, on February 24, 2024. For Ken Ludwig, it was almost an inevitability that he would one day take his hit farce Lend Me a Tenor, which had its debut in London's West End in 1986 and on Broadway in 1989, and deploy a gender swap. Over the past few years, I've made a real effort to have more female leads in my plays, says the Tony Award-winning playwright from his Northwest DC home one recent brisk, sunny morning. For example, when I wrote an adaptation of The Three Musketeers, I decided to give D'Artagnan a sister named Sabine who comes to Paris with him. She ends up being the heroine, because she's a great swordsman. At first you think, oh, she's the little sister tagging along, but she proves to be a real powerhouse. Ludwig says part of the motivation is to break the historical male-dominated model of traditional theater. Female actors have come to me and said, gee, I wish there were more standout parts for women, he says. And I get it, for 2,000 years it's been a very male-centric art, this theater of ours. He points to Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra as an example. Cleopatra is an incredible role, but she's the one really good female role among 10 men, he says. The notion arose to reconfigure the format of Lend Me a Tenor, in which Max, a nebbishy producer's assistant, must frantically babysit an out-of-control, world-famous, womanizing Italian opera star, and get him to the Cleveland Grand Opera Company in time for the performance. Of course, things go dreadfully, hysterically wrong. I've taken the three major roles of the play and turned them into women, says Ludwig of the revamped play, which had its premiere at the Alley Theater in Texas and is currently enjoying a successful run at the Olney Theater Center. It was not a matter of simply, oh, I'll just change their names. Women have different emotional ways of expressing themselves and different emotional feelings about things. So I rewrote the play from the ground up. The situation remains comedic, but the beats are different, says Ludwig. Here's a young person who's in a dilemma and has to save the day because, I don't want to give away any of the story, but there's a twist in it, he says. Many of the sexual innuendos in the original play had to be adjusted so that they didn't feel off-putting or, as Ludwig puts it, scuzzy. I've rewritten those scenes again to make them full of laughter and joy, but not feel uncomfortable, he says. Ludwig, whose 34 plays include the book for the Tony-winning musical Crazy for You, Moon Over Buffalo, and updated adaptations of Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, which is about to tour China, and Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur's 20th Century, still writes his plays the old-fashioned way, using pen and paper. I write by longhand, he confesses. I just like it. And what I like about it is it makes me feel very in touch with what I'm writing. It gives me a feeling that I'm really part of it. I use computers all the time, he continues. I write letters that way and essays, and this, that, and the other thing. But it all looks the same, all the letters are the same. It doesn't feel creative in the same way when maybe the pen I'm using that day is different or the handwriting is a little more scribbled, or I'm making notes to myself in the margins. The piece of paper and the pen give me a sense of connectedness to the material. I don't think you can write creative things on a typewriter. Of course, now I suppose everybody does it on computers, but I just can't, he laughs. I don't like it. I don't want to. Ken Ludwig's Lend Me a Soprano runs at the Olney Theatre Center's Roberts Main Stage. Visit www.olneytheatre.org.
Next we have, a savory and stylish, Merrily We Roll Along. Keegan Theatre's Merrily We Roll Along hums and dances fabulously, despite a few missteps and awkward touches. By Andre Herford, on February 19, 2024. Even before the beginning of the end, which is at the beginning in Stephen Sondheim and George Firth's backwards unfolding Merrily We Roll Along, blaring fanfares of the overture beg a question, where in the Keegan have they stashed the band? For the company's first foray into Sondheim, co-directors Christina A. Coakley and Jennifer J. Hopkins might have tucked conductor-keyboardist Nathan Beery Blestein and his nine-piece orchestra underneath or behind Matthew J. Keenan's sturdy, multi-level set, a layer cake in newsprint. Every surface of scenery is wrapped in newspaper pages marking events in the 20-year span covered in the show. Those pages of famous faces and arresting headlines must also serve as excellent soundproofing, since the band's sound doesn't bleed, but is channeled robustly through the speaker system. It's from there that the brass and woodwinds come blasting, at least at seat C12, occasionally overpowering the performer on stage. The initial wait for a pianissimo starts to seem conspicuous until we're served a sip of subtlety by Sarah Chapin, as party-pooping Mary Flynn. A boozer deep in her cups, Mary takes center stage at the opening Bel Air soiree, where nearly all assembled sing the praises of their host, that Frank, Hollywood producer Frank Shepard, rendered mellifluously by Ryan Burke as a savvy player often opting to downplay his drive. Frank might be the man Mary loves truly, but he's married to hottie stage and screen star Gussie, played by Sumi Yatsakura. Beyond simply suggesting lovesick, Chapin's three-dimensional take conveys volumes of story in Mary from the moment we meet her, not that Firth's book, or Sondheim's music and lyrics follow through much on what she really wants, unless it pertains to Frank. Still, Chapin confirms her fluency with Sondheim's distinctive flow in Old Friends / Like It Was, sung with Harrison Smith as Charlie Kringus, third in the show's trio of pals whose rocky road from best of friends to bitter enemies feels especially touching traced backwards. However, that bittersweet taste of resentment also frequently comes delivered with laughs. Smith hits just such a humming high point, with Charlie's jittery, seethingly angry Franklin Shepard Incorporated. Then comes the gut punch of the following scene, set years prior, showing Charlie full of joy, acting out of love for Frank, poignantly unaware of where their choices will someday lead them and their friendship. The audience is acutely aware of just how fragile their bonds may prove to be, so is not always led merrily to the dawn before the darkness. Yet, the lead trio of Chapin, Smith, and Burke maintain, regardless of the status of their characters' friendships, a winning compatibility on stage, supported by a game, if uneven, ensemble. Yatsakura brings a wealth of stage presence, but overacts Gussie's acid imperiousness. As Gussie's grasping ex-husband Joe, Dwayne Richards too could play it with the implications of the kind of hustler this Joe would have to be to succeed on Broadway in 1964. Or he could play the part as a generic impresario type, which is more where this Joe lands. It's one directorial choice along with staging that too often places scenes on the set's upper level, at an awkward distance from the audience that detracts from an otherwise engaging, movingly sincere production. Costumed brilliantly by Elizabeth Morton, lifted joyfully by Hopkins' jaunty choreography, Keegan's Merrily We Roll Along offers a savory, stylish serving of Sondheim, even if we sometimes might wish for a sound mix that better reigned in the band. Merrily We Roll Along earns 3 out of 5 stars. See it at the Keegan Theater in D.C. Visit www.keegantheater.com.
We head to Virginia today for our second review, titled, Private Jones is a Thrilling Musical Adventure. Signature's moving world premiere musical Private Jones marches boldly into a deaf soldier's odyssey at war. By Andre Herford, on February 19, 2024. Beautifully written, composed and directed by Marshall Pilette, and executed with panache and military precision, Signature's Private Jones poses a thrilling musical adventure in story and in form. The company's first world premiere musical since the pandemic, produced in association with Goodspeed Musicals, shrewdly deploys sign language, practical sound effects and silence, along with Pilette's compelling score, to shape the world of Private Gomer Jones, a deaf Welsh sniper in World War I. Inspired by a real-life World War I marksman, who was deaf since infancy, Private Jones comes firing to life in Johnny Link's feisty take on the role. Gomer, who loses his hearing as a child, is gutsy enough at 16 to fake his way past British Army recruitment officers, so he can join up and fight alongside his fellow borderers from Breconshire. Backed by the production's robust ensemble, he sings, bursting with hope, in the South Wales borderers of answering the nation's call. Moments later, innocence still guides him, as Gomer and company march through part of the sound, his vow to not simply soldier in step but truly prove his value in combat. Link ably captures Gomer's boyish voice and outlook and evolves the character in his dark, humbling descent into the trenches of war, though it's not the performer's singing that carries the characterization. Distinctly pleasing voices do surround him, notably, David Aaron Demain, lending his deep baritone to Gomer's father and other roles, and Leanne Antonio as Army Nurse Gwen Olin, leading the transporting ballad Every Soul's a Soul. Later reprised as Every Soldier, the intoxicating melody ripples like water, floating Gwendolyn's simple wisdom that every soul is a soul. At a time when Gomer is learning the cost of taking a life, she helps him reconsider the value of saving someone, even a wounded stray dog. Pilette's production gains a lot of mileage from the sentiment of a boy and his dog, thanks in large part to persuasive puppetry, but the show's not overly sentimental. It's downright brutal at times, powerfully evoking the horrors of war, soldiers riddled with bullets, survivors forced to use bodies as cover, though the carnage is rendered with astute, artful understatement. The deaths on stage aren't bloody or graphic, but the impact is profoundly felt. Gomer's losses cast long shadows as his odyssey carries him into combat in the fog-laden trenches, so vividly realized in Christopher and Justin Swader's scenic design. Luckily for Gomer and for us, he finds friends in the battalion who lift his spirits, like Aaron Weaver's rascally Charmer King, and Daimone Brewington's delightfully Daft Bailey, who provide laughs and warm camaraderie at the front. As a much less friendly fellow soldier, Edmund Vincent Michael brings appropriate tension to the drama, and soaring vocals to fantasy, among the score's most bright, romantic songs. Throughout, the company's voices combine gorgeously for dynamic interpretations of full cast numbers like The Rollicking Bastards and cleverly staged Cleaning a Gun, It's Easy. Misha Shields' choreography can look disjointed or busy, but the performers get to where they need to be in an epic narrative populated by troops of nurses and infantry. Meanwhile, Pilette keeps the story's shifting perspectives well-coordinated to portray myriad dimensions of Gomer's very particular experience as a revered marksman who can't hear the gunfire. Private Jones would have us all at least contemplate the silence Gomer inhabits to better understand the sounds of being deaf and the devastating noise of war. Private Jones earns 4 out of 5 stars. See it at Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia. Visit www.sigtheater.org.
Back in DC, we have our third review, Made to Measure. Constellation Theater hits a bullseye with Desperate Measures, a fun, frolicsome musical comedy western, inspired by Shakespeare, by Andre Herford, on February 24, 2024. Shakespearean romance and intrigue meet Mel Brooks-style slapstick in Constellation's rip-roaring production of Peter Kellogg and David Friedman's Desperate Measures. Loosely based on Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, the show was an award-winning hit in its original 2017 off-Broadway production. Heavily paring down the plot of Old Will's 420-year-old problem play, Kellogg's book and lyrics relocate the tale of crime and punishment from ducal Vienna to an archetypal Wild West town in 1890s Arizona. Composer Friedman supplies a versatile score of country western-inflected tunes that vary in style from a lonesome cowboy ballad to a Disney villain number to a comic burlesque for saloon singer, Bella, infused with just a hint of Madeline Kahn's Lily Von Stupp from Blazing Saddles. A few of the banjo-plunking songs sound ready-made for Kermit the Frog, who, along with his Muppet friends, would fit right in with the well-choreographed shenanigans of Allison Arkell Stockman's zany yet properly tense and romantic production. But until somebody gifts us the Muppet version of Desperate Measures, Constellation offers its own electric mayhem in the show's spirited four-player band, led by music director Rafi Tappan on piano, with some fine fiddling from Jason Labrador. The band adds cheek and character to the proceedings, as does scenic designer Samuel Kloss' charming, convertible small-scale version of a Wild West town, complete with its saloon stage, Christian mission, and town jail. Behind those bars, ne'er-do-well cowpoke Johnny Blood, played by Hunter Ringsmith, awaits the hangman's noose, unless his sister, rifle-toting nun Susanna, played by Julia Link, can somehow manage to save him. Luckily for her, kind-hearted Sheriff Martin Green, played by Tyler Dobies, is on her side, and, also, as the story progresses, enthrall to her determination, courage, and beauty. Unfortunately, for Susanna, brutish Governor von Richter Henkenplafitka Trubber, played by Greg Watkins, wants her to himself, and he's dead set on carrying out Johnny Blood's death sentence. That is, he bargains, unless she's willing to submit herself to a night with the governor, her chastity for her brother's freedom. As in Shakespeare, our heroine chooses chastity, which is none too convenient for Johnny, but a good plot turn for ramping up tension and comedy. Susanna and the sheriff will have to get creative in order to save both Johnny and her virtue, leading to the rousing team-up number, "It Doesn't Hurt to Try," sung with Johnny and his fellow jailbird, the perpetually drunk priest Father Morse, played by Bobby Libby. The priest also happens to be an atheist, just one amusing wrinkle on a broadly written role, well played by Libby. Each of the characters is drawn, and performed, with vivid texture despite still squarely fitting into a type. And the entire cast seems to find the sweet spot between send-up and seriousness, giving that extra bit of oomph that keeps the ball bouncing. Not all the big swings at physical comedy hit their target, but it's all in good fun. As resourceful novitiate Susanna and stalwart Sheriff Green, Link and Dobies sing their parts capably. They convey their love story subplot with sincerity, and, on Susanna's part, a pleasant sense of surprise. Essaying Johnny Saloon singer girlfriend Bella, Audrey Baker, apparently, a late addition to the cast, offers an adequate version of Bella's supposed showstopper, "It's Getting Hot in Here," but otherwise holds her own among the ensemble. Watkins appears to have the gayest time as mustache-twirling villain Von Richterhenkenpflicht Getrüber, laying down his self-aggrandizing screed, "Someday they will thank me." The costuming on the character isn't as effective as Susanna's habit, or the sheriff's duds, but with the way Watkins gleefully bites into the role, we can overlook the wardrobe and just enjoy the rhyming verse, Wild West crime drama, and a Shakespearean spoof where romance rules the day. Desperate Measures earns 4 out of 5 stars, at the Source Theatre, in D.C. Visit www.constellationtheatre.org.
We finish our set of reviews now, with Woolly Mammoths. The sensational Seeming Cats kicks off with a sensational first half but doesn't sustain its fine form. By Andre Herford, on February 24, 2024. Vivian J. O'Barnes' sharp-edged comedy, The Sensational Seeming Cats, plunges deep into the hearts and psyches of its titular all-female team of dancers at an unnamed historically black college. Woolly Mammoth's world premiere production, directed by Taylor Reynolds, starts stronger than it finishes, but, throughout, the vivacious cast rarely misses a beat, hitting the hilarious highs and crushing emotional lows of Barnes' enigmatic narrative. Leading the ensemble, Billy Chrishan leaves a powerful impression as team captain Shanti, a senior seeming cat knee-deep in her first season wielding the clipboard as crew leader. Shanti speaks quietly but leads loudly with poise and confidence, getting her ladies into formation for an upcoming halftime performance at homecoming. The team does most of its practicing in the stands of the school football stadium, rendered by scenic designer Paige Hathaway as a steep bank of aluminum bleachers topped by field lamps, looming over a patch of green turf. Exquisitely designed to suggest your local HBCU stadium, and the set of Beyoncé's legendary HBCU-themed homecoming concert performance at Coachella, these metal stands are where the play's fictional universe and real life converge. That's especially true for Beyoncé-obsessed team member Kiki, played by Sabrina Lynn Sawyer. Guided by the empowering voice of Queen Bey in her head, Kiki might be merely applying healthy tools of self-motivation, or she might actually hear voices that she chooses to believe are Beyoncé. Sawyer's nuanced performance intrigues, as we question Kiki's sanity, while she maintains the appearance of being the most calm, attentive-seeming cat. Not at all calm, team members and besties Raquel, played by Kaylin Robinson, and Gabby, played by Kalia Muhammad, bring brazen attitudes and disruptive energy to dance practice, along with a perspective routine set to their provocative original song, Pussy Pop. Robinson and Muhammad also provide much of the show's laugh-out-loud comedy, not to mention some smooth dance moves. In keeping with the play's intent to poke at a variety of issues faced by all young women, and black women, specifically, even light-hearted characters Raquel and Gabby add serious takes on sexual agency and slut-shaming to the pot of hot topics the playwright's stirring. Rounding out the crew, disciplined senior Maya, played by Kimberly Dodson, former team leader, seems overwhelmed trying to complete her thesis, and newbie Alays, played by Lauren Freites, is buckling under the pressure of living up to the seeming cat legacy built by her mom and grandmother. All the ladies' problems and concerns loom over Shanti's efforts to tighten up their dance routine. "Breathe pretty," she tells them. No one wants to see all that panting. Seeming cats are held to a standard of always epitomizing elegance, effortlessness, and elegance. No one must see the struggle. That's a powerful theme on the conditions of womanhood, one of many themes that Barnes introduces organically to a story that gradually unravels, as fun and friendship give way to vague mystery and creeping existential dread. No concern looms larger over the seeming Kets than the unexplained absence of two team members, Nikki and Dion, who never show up to practice. And the mystery only deepens in the days leading up to the homecoming performance, with the sudden disappearance of other team members. We see enough to wonder about the unfortunate possibilities abuse, abortion, eating disorders, or suicide, but answers aren't forthcoming, as if the girls are vanishing one by one into a void. All Shanti can do is keep asking, and decry the total lack of response from authorities and school administrators, expressing the common frustration that missing persons of color stay missing. Still, it's clear something untoward is happening. And in case anyone didn't already get the picture, Barnes has Shanti announce that the existential dread she feels is creeping closer. But what happens as the pressure builds? The play seems to get lost in the mystery, swinging on loose threads into a vision of the afterlife, or an alternate dimension, where some seeming Kets find themselves. Reynolds stages these scenes in pitch-dark lighting, with the performers in a shallow pit at the foot of the stage, where, from my seat in the rear orchestra, they couldn't be seen at all. Their disembodied voices thus carried the seeming Kets story towards its uncertain conclusion, while I watched the back of a patron's head bobbing to the beat. The sensational seeming Kets earns 3 out of 5 stars. Visit the Woolly Mammoth Theatre website for more details, www.woollymammoth.net.
That's all for today's edition of our podcast today. Thank you for tuning in again. Please visit us at metroweekly.com for more arts-related news and reviews. And if you enjoyed this show, please hit like, share and leave a comment through your podcast provider.